Thank you, Emiko. It's a delight to be here with all of you. I'm joining you from Johannesburg, South Africa. This area is the unceded land of the San people who are my ancestry. So we're going to sit together for about 30 minutes. I'll give it a talk. And there will be time for question and response. So I invite you to unhurriedly find a posture that's going to support your practice. Taking time to settle into an upright posture allowing your own spine to support you sensing into the support of earth noticing places where the body makes contact, the hardness of the chair or cushion, sensing into your feet, firmly planted on earth if you're on a chair. Extending your awareness to the space around the body. Really taking your time here, invite ease, relaxation by softening what can be softened. As you breathe in, gathering the attention around your breath. As you breathe out, dropping the attention into your body. Aware of each breath, and just knowing breath as it is happening. Breathing in and breathing out. Letting the attention rest. And the flow of the breath coming in, going out. Noticing movement of breathing. What do you feel in the body while breathing in? What do you feel in the body while breathing out? And hurriedly settling into the rhythm of the breath, feeling what happens in the body when you breathe in. And what happens when you breathe out? How far throughout the body do you feel the impact of an in-breath and out-breath? Let the breath happen naturally. Let it come and go as it will. You're just present to feel the breath as it happens in the body. As you remain connected to the present moment, simply feel the breath coming in and the breath going out, sensitive to the whole body. Perhaps you now start to notice where in the body you feel the breath most clearly. For some people, the breath is most clear at the nose as it goes in and comes out at the nostrils. Some may feel the breath most clearly in the abdomen as the belly rises and falls with each breath. Others might feel it mostly in the rise and fall of the chest. And others may feel the whole breath as it comes in through the nose, expands the chest, and then the belly. If you feel the breath most clearly in one of these ways, let that area now become the focus for your attention. giving your full attention to the experience in the body of each in-breath and each out-breath. Wherever it is clearest for you, nose, belly, chest, or whole breath. Perhaps lost in thought, not a problem. This happens a lot in meditation. The moment you notice that the attention has gone away to thinking, you are back in the present moment. Mindfulness is remembering. Remember to come home to the present moment. Resting the attention with the experience of breathing. You may find it helpful to make a note, a soft mental label of the experience of breathing in, breathing out, silently, softly saying to yourself, in, out. The note can be helpful to keep you connected to the physical experience of breathing. when using the noting, try to keep that in the background, letting most of your attention stay with a direct experience in the body of each breath. For the remainder of the meditation, please continue to be present for the experience of breathing in and breathing out. I invite you to stretch if you need to stretch. It's a joy to be with you today to reflect on the teachings of the Buddha. A much loved teacher from Sri Lanka who used to come to South Africa, Godwin Samraratne, who's long passed on, at one retreat here, he overhears the yogis talking excitedly about a book on transactional analysis by Eric Benn. One of the expressions in transactional analysis is that I'm okay and you are okay. And then Godwin, in hearing this, laughs and then says, "No, I'm not okay. You're not okay. That's okay." So this expression really speaks to the heart of this practice. The Buddha says, I teach one thing, suffering, and the ending of suffering. So, what's the purpose then of practice? The purpose of practice is to look towards suffering, opening the heart to this human experience of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness of experience. At the heart of this practice, we are invited, encouraged to look, to accept, to embrace suffering. Mark Nepo, in a poem, beautifully articulates this idea of opening to suffering, where he says, having loved enough and lost enough, I'm no longer searching, just opening. No longer trying to make sense of pain, but being a soft and steady home in which real things can land. These are the irritations that rub to a pearl. Recently, I've been asking practitioners to reflect on the purpose of practice. And some of their responses included to look, to listen, respond appropriately, bow to life. So the invitation is to observe, watch the mind, so that for yourself you can come to an understanding of how this mind creates suffering. if you're really watching your mind, you'll notice this constant movement of the mind that relates to wanting and not wanting. I don't want what I have. I want what I don't have. And this is constant. If you are a good observer of your own mind, the First Noble Truth invites us to understand suffering. Understand the experience that comes with this constant wanting and not wanting. The emotions, bodily experience, thoughts, sensations that come with wanting and not wanting. Anxiety, fear, sadness, desires, just constant dissatisfaction. I mean, this can start as you get up in the morning. You don't want to get out of bed, right? Just as you open your eyes. Thoughts about your day, thoughts about tomorrow, next week, continuously planning in an attempt to feel safe. And the idea of feeling safe, feeling secure, it's something that as human beings, we all want. Do we ever question the source of this need for safety? I think it's a need that comes from this deep sense of lack. Nothing can ever be enough, at least not for long. It's not your fault that you suffer. It's not my fault that I suffer. It is like this. There is suffering. This is what the Buddha says. As soon as we come into contact through the senses in our lives, if we're paying attention to our experience, there is this natural arising of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. You can come into this meeting and notice things you like, you don't like. So it just happens, right? How can it be your fault? And then, of course, from that unpleasantness, maybe the mind then starts to label, create stories. Which then inclines us in a specific direction in relation to our actions. All of this coming from that pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experience. And there's this big story. A teacher, a writer, I find particularly courageous in her teachings, in encouraging us to look at suffering as Pema Chodron. I mean, even just looking at the title, I was looking at the title of all her books. This one, wisdom of no escape. What's she talking about there? She's just talking about suffering. The other one, when things fall apart. She's pointing us to there. It's suffering. And then I really laughed at this one that's titled Fail, Fail, Again, Fail. So she really just takes this most difficult thing called suffering. She really just takes it on. And I think this is useful because our conditioning, our cultural, social conditioning, encourages us to look away from suffering. The message is achieve, succeed, don't fail. But if we really, really want to alleviate our suffering, free the heart from the suffering of wanting and not wanting, create hatred reinforced by ignorance, delusion, we will read more of Pema Chodron's books. A friend of mine who's new to Buddhism, in reading this core teaching of the Four Noble Truths, where the Buddha says, starts off says there is suffering. She's like, she giggles and she's like, ah, the Buddha names the elephant in the room here. Right? Suffering when we don't fully acknowledge this. You know, it's like that situation of the emperor without clothes. There is suffering. An expression from Pema. In relation to this, she says, to live fully is to be always in no man's land. She's not talking about security, certainty. She's saying no man's land. She's pointing us to this reality of impermanence, of uncertainty. You and I largely suffer because we assume permanence. We want to stay young. I noticed that, especially at my age, I turned 60 a month ago. We want to stay healthy. We want to live forever. We assume we will live forever. If you look at how largely we live our lives, if we really truly understood this teaching of impermanence, I think we would be more diligent in our practice, which are actually diligence is actually a word that the Buddha uses as he is dying. His last words are, all conditioned things break down. Practice diligently. a teacher of my teachers, Ajahn Chah. This was his main teaching, the teaching on impermanence. He would just say, not sure, not sure. That was his core teaching. Nothing is certain. Having had the same teachers for a long time, Kittisara and Tsanusara, who were disciples of Ajahn Chah, I had many stories over the years. So one of the funny stories regarding this teaching from Ajahn Chah, not sure, not sure. He is invited by his students to London, and this was his first visit. So, a small community then, the community that became Amaravati under Ajahn Sumedho. I think then they were living in an apartment in London. So they had invited people to come and listen to this master from Thailand, highly revered master, Ajahn Chah. So the key organizer on the day of the talk of Ajahn Chah, from time to time, he would ask Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Chah, are you going to give a talk? And then Ajahn Chah would smile and say, not sure, not sure. And of course, the student is really nervous because they've invited all these people. So at some point, Ajahn Chah, said, okay, I'll teach. So this was his way of teaching. He was popular for frustrating desire. If he sees that the students are attached to this idea, he would frustrate that. Where is he going with that? He's encouraging them to see this mental state of desire, this wanting, being the source of our suffering. We make plans. Not a bad thing to make plans. The problem is that we can go over the same plan 100 times, in a way, therefore leaning continuously into the future. And yet all is not sure, really. Right? We have expectations of ourselves, of life, of others. I must, I should. Not sure. Not sure. It is this very orientation of the mind of searching for what's pleasant and moving away from what is unpleasant that intensifies this feeling of dissatisfaction. Unsatisfactoriness, to stress, to suffering. And of course, if we're living our lives with these ideas, I should, I must, there's an impact. We tighten up, we're tense. We contracted more suffering in that state of being that then will lead to more seeking, right? Out of this experience of constant suffering, we tend towards entertainment. We're busy, we buy. So the focus is this sense stimulation. which actually feeds itself? When has it been enough? When there's a moment of getting what you want? How long does that feeling of being okay, satisfied, actually last? It can't, because desire feeds itself. So you can say it's a dead-end road. This is not how we can get to well-being. This is not how we can get to spiritual fulfillment, which is what I think you and I want. That's why we practice, isn't it? You know this the story of Nasruddin, this Sufi mystic. He's outside a spice shop, and there is this basket of very strong chilies, and he's eating this, and eyes are watering. And then a friend comes along and like, Nasruddin, what are you doing? You're burning from these chilies you're eating. And then he says, I'm looking for the sweet one. So where are we looking for what we truly want? Are we looking at the right places? Because I even notice in the Buddhist community, I think I know this even for myself. We can, for starters, dabble in and out, in and out, not truly committing. If not that, we find we can use practice as another way of avoiding suffering. You know, this term called spiritual bypass, where we use spiritual religious teachings and practices to actually avoid the wounding, the suffering that comes from our wounding, traumas, difficult emotions. So it is quite a challenge and a big task to really be heedful, be diligent, and really be curious about what is it that the Buddha wants me to do here? What is he suggesting that will bring relief, release, that which will bring about well-being, that which will meet this yearning for spiritual fulfillment? Do we have an understanding of the path to the end of the suffering? The Noble Eightfold Path starts with right understanding, right view about the path to the ending of suffering. So right view is alive when we reflect, we come to an understanding of the noble, of the Four Noble Truths, which starts with suffering, know suffering, understand suffering, embrace suffering. So a good place to start is, I'm not okay. You're not okay. And that is okay. Notice just how that lands to know that it's okay. We make suffering a problem, therefore, we will try to solve it. I remember in my very first retreat, when I heard this expression, "We are not okay, that's okay," I thought, wow, that's a radical thought. I've never heard of this in my life. The message is that if you are not okay, you are failing. Fake it until you make it. I mean, for me, that was really just a relief that somebody here was telling the truth, that there is suffering. So what do we do? How do we get to know suffering? A colleague I teach with here shares a story where Ajahn Suchiro, who'd been coming to South Africa for the last 30 years, when she asked Ajahn Suchiro, "How can I deepen my practice?" And this is a common question, actually, from us as practitioners. How do we deepen our practice? Because obviously the answer is practice. And then Ajahn Suchiro's response is body awareness. And my colleague and friend says to me, "I was disappointed, because sometimes we're expecting that this practice has to be about, I don't know, some magic or esoteric experiences." Body awareness. Bringing the attention to the body. This is how you're going to understand suffering. So the most celebrated teaching, actually, in Buddhism, it's the in these teachings, it is the Satipatthana Sutta. It's the most celebrated. It starts off with mindfulness of body. Why mindfulness of body, mindfulness of breath? Why is Buddhism bringing the body right at the center of this practice? It's a good question to ask yourself and contemplate. Because it's obvious we are disembodied. We live in our thoughts, we live in our stories. And these stories are stories largely of the future, if not of the past. So we're hardly really present in this moment. And it is true being embodied that we can connect with our lived experience, not our thoughts about some future or past, but our lived experience. What's the life in the body right now? What's the activity of the mind? Do we have a sense of what is happening right now? This is what mindfulness is about. Very important qualities of mindfulness. It's clear comprehension and ardency. Clear comprehension is inquiring into your experience in the here and now. What's happening? Ardency, it's about wholeheartedness in what we are doing when we are doing it. This is right mindfulness. And in bringing attention to the body, we then have access to a resource that can begin to bring ease, a sense of relaxation, which is actually quite pleasant when there is this awareness in the life of the body, this ease, relaxation. The attention we bring to the body regulates the nervous system. And when the nervous system is regulated, there's a sense of well-being. It's a shift from that continuous fight-flight response that comes with this continuous movement of the mind of wanting and not wanting. Then the whole system with that movement really contracts and we're tense. So very important in this practice is inviting ease, sense into the pleasure of just mindfulness of breath, just being mindful of breathing in, breathing out, as the whole system releases tension. It's actually a pleasurable experience. I never understood for the longest time practicing that actually the Buddha was about pleasure. Blameless pleasure that comes from the mind itself. That comes from this practice of mindfulness of breath. Because remember, the Buddha's path was the ascetic path, depriving the body. And then at some point he realizes, no, this is not the path to enlightenment. I'm going to continue searching. And then he has a memory being a child of being content and at peace from the breathing easefully and remembering the pleasure of that experience and thinking, why am I scared of pleasure? This might well be the path to awakening. So this first foundation of mindfulness of body, mindfulness of breath, is actually the practice that connects us to the wisdom of the Buddha. We are not going to get to being diligent in this practice without some joy, without some enjoyment of the practice itself. So this is a different pleasure. It's not the pleasure of the senses. That's a dead end because it feeds itself. There's no end to it. I also want to talk about other practices that provide us with an uplift, practices that can pick us up and carry us in this path. Generosity, devotional practices, heart practices. These are important. Because from a mind, if we have a mind state of generosity, we see that by sharing what we have, by placing the mind in a place of goodwill, this gives us an uplift. I feel fortunate having been brought up in an African culture. The underlying principle in African culture is, generosity. It's a principle of Ubuntu. What that means is, I am because we are. As a child, for example, you belong to a village, you belong to a community. You have many mothers, you have many fathers. A friend was doing some project in a school not long ago, and in this village, then she asked the kids to draw their homes. Every child in that class, the drawing was about the whole village. And this person is a white person, was a bit confused. Where's your home? Which of these is your home? Children are confused. All of these are my homes. So, from an early age, these values of being a part of the whole is really an important life experience. An elder who is a mentor, a spiritual guide for Dhammagiri, Baba Mandaza, says, you can't understand Ubuntu or kindness by reading a book. Go where there is kindness, then you will know about kindness. Yes, there are beautiful practices in Buddhism on using phrases. I don't know how is it for you, but for me, they don't always work. Sometimes they just feel mechanistic, right? Go where there is kindness, then you'll know what kindness is. Because your heart already knows what kindness is. It will recognize it when it sees it, when it experiences it. I also want to talk about devotional practices because, also, as Africans, we dance, we sing, whether we're in sorrow or in joy. There's something uplifting. This word is important. What uplifts the heart? Be curious about that because it's going to support your practice. It's fertile ground for concentration practices when we have this sense of belonging, uplifted, connected. So I love devotional practices. I love chanting. And fortunately, I've had teachers who that was always a part of their practice. The interesting thing actually is that during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission here in South Africa, post apartheid, there was this process aimed at racial reconciliation specifically. So there would be these commissions where you have a perpetrator and a victim. Perpetrators who were people who were the machinery of state, who killed activists. So there will be these situations. Maybe it is a parent of that person who was killed by this person, and there will be moments that are really, really tense and painful. So Archbishop Tutu was the leader of the TRC, would just sometimes, get up and start singing hymns and dance, and everybody would join in. And this would bring a sense of relief, an opportunity for healing, opportunity for forgiveness, for compassion. Just a last story I'm going to share with you because I don't want you to have time to ask questions. My mom died at the end of December last year. She was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. So she came to Joburg for treatment and lived with me for about 3 months. And the last 10 days, she was hospitalized. And it was still during the height of COVID, so there were restrictions. So, as one of the family members who was allowed to visit, I spent a lot of time with her in the last 10 days of her life. So, what we do, we'd sing hymns. I was brought up Catholic, and she was a devoted Catholic. We would sing until, maybe the last day or the day before she passed on, we sang. And that was the most intimate time actually with my mother. And the most surprising thing was that there was no grief. I experienced no grief because there was so much joy and so much love during those last 10 days of her life. So we do need practices that will uplift us, pick us up, and carry us in this path of liberating this heart from greed, hatred, and delusion.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.